Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday Denver Post, read by Doug Crane. This is being recorded on June 29th, 2024. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. Supreme Court, Justices Weaken Federal Agencies, by Mark Sherman, The Associated Press. Election 2024, Democrats Sticking by President, For Now, by Zeke Miller, Steve Peoples, and Darlene Superville, The Associated Press. Tattered Cover, CEO, Bookstores to Chart Own Course, Barnes & Noble Executive Visits Denver, Chain Has Made Bid to Buy Storied Business, by Judith Kohler, The Denver Post, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Supreme Court, Justices Weaken Federal Agencies, by Mark Sherman, The Associated Press. Washington, the Supreme Court on Friday upended a 40-year-old decision that made it easier for the federal government to regulate the environment, public health, workplace safety, and consumer protections, delivering a far-reaching and potentially lucrative victory to business interests. The court's six conservative justices overturned the 1984 decision, colloquially known as Chevron, long a target of conservatives who have been motivated as much by weakening the regulatory state as social issues, including abortion. The liberal justices were in dissent. The case was the conservative-dominated court's clearest and boldest repudiation yet of what critics of regulation call the administrative state. Billions of dollars are potentially at stake in challenges that could be spawned by the high court's ruling. The Biden administration's top Supreme Court lawyer had warned such a move would be an unwarranted shock to the legal system. The heart of the Chevron decision says federal agencies should be allowed to fill in the details when laws aren't crystal clear. Opponents of the decision argued that it gave power that should be wielded by judges to experts who work for the government. Courts must exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the court. Roberts wrote that the decision does not call into question prior cases that relied on the Chevron decision. But in dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote that the assurance rings hollow. "The majority is sanguine. I am not so much," she wrote. Kagan called the latest decision yet another example of the court's resolve to roll back agency authority, despite congressional direction to the contrary. Just a day earlier, the same lineup of justices stripped the Securities and Exchange Commission of a major tool used in fighting fraud. The court ruled in cases brought by Atlantic herring fishermen in New Jersey and Rhode Island who challenged a fee requirement. Lower courts used the Chevron decision to uphold a 2020 National Marine Fisheries Service rule that herring fishermen pay for government-mandated observers who track their fish intake. Conservative and business interests strongly backed the fishermen's appeals, betting that a court that was remade during Republican Donald Trump's presidency would strike another blow at the regulatory state. The court's conservative majority previously reined in environmental regulations and stopped the Democratic Biden administration's initiatives on COVID-19 vaccines and student loan forgiveness. The justices hadn't invoked Chevron since 2016, but lower courts had continued to do so. 40 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled 6-0, with three justices recused, that judges should play a limited deferential role when evaluating the actions of agency experts in a case brought by environmental groups to challenge a Reagan administration effort to ease regulation of power plants and factories. Judges are not experts in the field and are not part of either political branch of government, Justice John Paul Stevens wrote in 1984, explaining why they should play a limited role. But the current high court, with a 6-3 conservative majority, has been increasingly skeptical of the powers of federal agencies. Justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Clarence Thomas all had questioned the Chevron decision. They were in Friday's majority, along with Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Roberts' opinion took direct aim at what Stevens wrote 40 years ago. That depends, of course, on what the field is. If it is legal interpretation, that has been emphatically the province and duty of the Judicial Department for at least 221 years, Roberts wrote, quoting the Marbury v. Madison decision that established the Supreme Court as the last word in interpreting laws and the Constitution. Kagan, though, said getting rid of Chevron gives courts control over matters they know nothing about. She read a summary of her dissent aloud to emphasize her disagreement with the majority. Justices Ketanji Brown Jackson and Sonia Sotomayor joined Kagan in dissent. Opponents of the Chevron doctrine argue that judges applied it too often to rubber-stamp decisions made by government bureaucrats. Judges must exercise their authority and judgment to say what the law is, the court said Friday. Bill Bright, a Cape May, New Jersey-based fisherman who was part of the lawsuit, said the decision to overturn Chevron would help fishing businesses make a living. Nothing is more important than protecting the livelihoods of our families and crews, Bright said in a statement. Reacting to the decision, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the ruling is yet another deeply troubling decision that takes our country backward. Republican-backed special interests have repeatedly turned to the Supreme Court to block common-sense rules that keep us safe, protect our health and environment, safeguard our financial system, and support American consumers and workers. Federal agencies and the Justice Department already had begun reducing their reliance on the Chevron decision in crafting and defending new regulations. Environmental, health advocacy groups, civil rights organizations, organized labor, and Democrats on the national and state level had urged the court to leave the Chevron decision in place. The Supreme Court is pushing the nation into uncharted waters as it seizes power from our elected branches of government to advance its deregulatory agenda. Samhav Sankar, a lawyer with the environmental group Earth Justice, said after the ruling. Election 2024. Democrats sticking by president for now. By Zeke Miller, Steve Peoples, and Darlene Superville, The Associated Press. Washington. President Joe Biden worked forcefully Friday to quell Democratic anxieties over his unsteady showing in his debate with former President Donald Trump as elected members of his party closed ranks around him to shut down talk of replacing him atop the ticket. Biden's halting delivery and meandering comments, particularly early in the debate, fueled concerns from even members of his own party that at age 81, he's not up for the task of leading the country for another 4 years. It created a crisis moment for Biden's campaign and his presidency as members of his party flirted with potential replacements and donors and supporters couldn't contain their concern about his showing against Trump. Biden appeared to acknowledge the criticism during a rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, saying, "I don't debate as well as I used to," but he added, "I know how to do this job. I know how to get things done." Speaking for 18 minutes, Biden appeared far more animated than he had the night before as he excoriated Trump for his lies and for waging a campaign aimed at revenge and retribution. "The choice in this election is simple," Biden said. "Donald Trump will destroy our democracy. I will defend it." He added, alluding to his candidacy, "When you get knocked down, you get back up." Even before the debate, Biden's age had been a liability with voters, and Thursday night's face-off appeared to reinforce the public's deep-seated concerns before perhaps the largest audience he will garner in the 4 months until Election Day. Privately, his campaign worked to tamp down concerns and keep donors and surrogates on board. Democratic lawmakers on Friday acknowledged Biden's poor showing, but tried to stop talk of replacing him as their standard bearer. They instead shifted the focus to Trump's attacks and falsehoods. Well, the president didn't have a good night, but neither did Donald Trump with lie after lie and his dark vision for America. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper told the Associated Press on Friday, hours before he introduced the president in Raleigh, "We cannot send Donald Trump back to the White House. He's an existential threat to our nation." Former President Barack Obama backed up his former vice president, posting on X that bad debate nights happen, alluding to his own poor showing in his first debate of his reelection campaign in 2012. Obama continued, "Trust me, I know, but this election is still a choice between someone who has fought for ordinary folks his entire life and someone who only cares about himself." He added, "Last night didn't change that, and it's why so much is at stake in November." House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries answered with a flat no when asked Friday if Biden should step aside. Representative Richie Torres, Democrat of New York, allowed he had to take a few more antidepressants than usual after Biden's debate showing. But he added that a Donald Trump presidency would cause me far greater discomfort than a Joe Biden debate performance. Biden's campaign billed the Raleigh event as the largest yet rally of his reelection bid in the state Trump carried by the narrowest margin in 2020. He then traveled to New York for a weekend of big-dollar fundraisers that his campaign now needs more than ever. Biden's campaign announced it raised $14 million on debate day and the morning after, while Trump's campaign said it raised more than $8 million from the start of the debate through the end of the night. Vice President Kamala Harris, whom the Biden campaign sent out to defend his performance, tried to reassure Biden supporters at a rally in Las Vegas on Friday, saying, "This race will not be decided by one night in June. The race will be decided by you, by us," she said. "Who sits in the White House next year will be determined by what we together do in these next 130 days. Biden campaign communications director Michael Tyler said there had been no internal conversations whatsoever about Biden stepping aside, although he too acknowledged that the president had a bad night on stage. Representative Emmanuel Cleaver, Democrat of Missouri, said he could hardly sleep because of the number of telephone calls he got after Biden performed horribly in the debate. "People were just concerned, and I told everybody being concerned is healthy. Overreacting is dangerous," Cleaver said. Representative James Clyburn, a South Carolina Democrat whose support in that state helped Biden secure the Democratic nomination 4 years ago, said he would likely speak to Biden later Friday, and his message would be simple: stay the course. Biden and his team have long wagered that voters would look past their concerns about his age and unpopularity when confronted at the ballot box with a choice between the president and Trump. Despite their concerns about Biden's performance, they took solace in Trump doing little to expand his own appeal to voters on Thursday. Polls from CNN and 538 Ipsos, conducted soon after the debate, found that most debate watchers thought Trump outperformed Biden. But the two men's favorability ratings remained largely unchanged, just as they did in the aftermath of Trump's conviction. Democrats seized on Trump's equivocations on whether he would accept the will of voters this time around, his refusal to condemn the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, trying to overturn his 2020 loss to Biden, and his embrace of the conservative-leaning Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade that had legalized abortion nationwide. But Biden fumbled on abortion rights, one of the most important issues for Democrats in this year's election. He was unable to explain Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. As elected Democrats united behind Biden publicly, donors and party operatives shared panicked text messages and phone calls Thursday night and into Friday, expressing their concerns that Biden's performance was so bad that he may be unelectable this fall. Among the few public Democratic voices calling on Biden to step aside was congressional candidate Nancy Boida in Kansas, who broke with most in her party and called on Biden to suspend his campaign and retire at the end of his current term. But there were no immediate signs of organized efforts among donors, his campaign leadership, or the Democratic National Committee to convince the president to step aside, according to interviews with several people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share sensitive conversations. Under current Democratic Party rules, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to replace Biden as the party's nominee without his cooperation or without party officials being willing to rewrite the rules at the August National Convention. Tattered cover. CEO. Bookstores to chart own course. Barnes & Noble executive visits Denver. Chain has made bid to buy storied business. By Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. When it comes to how a sale of Tattered Cover to Barnes & Noble would change the storied Denver bookstore, James Dunn is insistent that will be up to the team managing and staffing the business. Dunn, CEO of Barnes & Noble, was in Denver on Friday and today to talk to Tattered Cover's booksellers or employees. Barnes & Noble, the country's largest bookseller, has offered $1.83 million in cash to buy Tattered Cover out of bankruptcy, covering $50,000 in back rent and $1.6 million in secured debt the store owes. Tattered Cover's parent company, Bended Page, approved the offer June 17th, but the agreement needs the approval of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Denver. The closing is set to take place by July 31st. After a short stint as an investment banker, Dunn opened a few bookstores in Britain. He later became managing director or CEO of Waterstones, Britain's largest bookstore chain, and then CEO of Barnes & Noble, but still has his own stores. "I'm a student of other bookstores. I've visited Tattered Cover in the past," Dunn told the Denver Post, while sitting at a table among the bookcases at the store's main location on Denver's East Colfax Avenue. "It's obviously one of the great names in bookselling," Dunn added. And although TC Acquisition Company, LLC, an affiliate of Barnes & Noble, has made an offer on the store, Dunn insisted that the book chain doesn't plan to remake the 53-year-old independent business in some kind of corporate image. "Barnes & Noble isn't coming in as such. It's providing all of the structure. We're there to provide all that is necessary for the teams to run a good bookstore," Dunn said. Tattered Cover is going to figure out how it becomes Tattered Cover again. After taking the helm at Waterstones and Barnes & Noble, Dunn said he has encouraged employees to run stores like independent booksellers. "It's the store team that runs a good bookstore, whether it's the Barnes & Noble in Fort Collins or Tattered Cover here," Dunn said. "Some of them will do it brilliantly, some of them will do it shockingly awfully, and some of them in between." In Britain, Waterstones has bought well-known independent bookstores that still operate under their original names, such as Blackwell's, Hatchard's, Foyle's, and Hodges Figgis. "What we've done is really empower those teams to reinvent themselves back to what they were," Dunn said. "Hatchard's now is most definitely not a Waterstones. It's Hatchard's. It's a very, very distinct and different bookstore and dramatically more successful as a consequence of that." Hatchard's is the oldest bookshop in the United Kingdom and the official bookseller to the royal household, according to its website. The agreement between Bended Page and Barnes & Noble calls for the bookstore to continue operating under the name of the Tattered Cover Bookstore and to continue its program of events. All four metro area locations will remain open. Dunn said he hopes the vast majority of Tattered Cover's approximately 70 employees will want to stay on staff. The lease on the East Colfax store will be extended through 2038, and the lease on the store in the Aspen Grove Shopping Center in Littleton would run through 2030. Under the ownership of Joyce Meskis, Tattered Cover Bookstore became a Denver icon that hosted former presidents, future presidents, Barack Obama, and literary luminaries through the decades. Tattered Cover also forged a national reputation for fighting censorship and defending First Amendment rights. In 2017, book industry veterans Len Vlahos and his wife Kristen Gilligan acquired controlling interest in the Tattered Cover. Bended Page, founded by Denver natives Kwame Spearman and David Back, bought the struggling company in 2020. Tattered Cover filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy less than a year after the death of Meskis in December 2022. The parent company put the bookstore up for sale in March. University of Colorado. Study finds 59% of older adults stay home more since COVID-19. By Olivia Doak, Daily Camera. Boulder. For many older adults, the pandemic has left lasting impacts on their lives. Jessica Finley, a professor at the University of Colorado, surveyed approximately 7,000 people ages 55 or older from all 50 states. She found more than half of older adults spend more time at home and less time socializing in public spaces since the pandemic. The pandemic is not over, and it's not a return back to complete pre-pandemic normal, Finley said. People still find certain places challenging for varied reasons. Finley began the survey shortly after the pandemic began in 2020 and has continued to follow up with participants to see how their lives are impacted over time. The results show that 59% of people reported spending more time at home and 75% eat out less often. The survey also showed that 57% exercised indoors less, 62% visited an arts or cultural site less, and 53% attended religious services less often. A lot of our society has snapped back, let's say, to maybe not pre-COVID normal, but a new normal and has re-engaged, Finley said. But there's a lot of privilege embedded in that ability to return. And then there are many folks that are being left behind. Yarman Ye, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, was part of the analysis team for the open-ended survey responses. Ye said places such as grocery stores, churches, and airports changed in meaning and safety for older adults. Many are afraid of getting sick or infecting immunocompromised loved ones. Others reported being yelled at or judged when wearing a mask in public. We don't want to further divide society, so I hope we draw attention to those being left behind, Finley said. I hope we can encourage more public policy and community efforts to support a variety of folks. Ye said the pandemic was an opportunity to develop creative ideas to meet people's health and social needs. I think one of the neat things that came out of the pandemic, at least momentarily, were these pop-up dining rooms where restaurants have outdoor seating on sidewalks, Ye said, adding, as the years went by and the fear of the pandemic reduced, these neat arrangements went away. Finley says there's power in small interactions for people of all ages. That could include encountering people at a daycare pickup, making small talk with the cashier at a grocery store, or spending time in a public park or coffee shop. It's those kind of informal ties, those community ways of just encountering people, Finley said, adding, people talk about losing that contact, and the scientific literature tells us that contact is literally protective of individual health. Having a diversity and greater number of different social ties has been linked to living longer and living healthier. Ye said the pandemic was a moment to pause and rethink urban planning and the importance of having a wide variety of places and policies that accommodate various needs. We don't often think about how our social or built environments also influence how we feel and how we are able to be healthy or not, Ye said. Finley said there's a need to continue to have open air and outdoor spaces, well-ventilated indoor spaces, and mask-encouraged events. On the individual level, she said it can make a difference to smile and greet people on the street and be aware of the importance of togetherness, even if it's simply existing in a place alone like a park where people are around. We will have more pandemics, we will have more emergencies, and we need to think about how to support everyone, Finley said. Supreme Court. Court limits federal obstruction law. By Mark Sherman, The Associated Press, Washington. The Supreme Court on Friday limited a federal obstruction law that has been used to charge hundreds of Capitol riot defendants, as well as former President Donald Trump. The justices ruled 6-3 that the charge of obstructing an official proceeding, enacted in 2002 in response to the financial scandal that brought down Enron Corporation, must include proof that defendants tried to tamper with or destroy documents. Only some of the people who violently attacked the Capitol on January 6, 2021, fall into that category. The overwhelming majority of the approximately 1,000 people who have been convicted of or pleaded guilty to Capitol riot-related federal crimes were not charged with obstruction and will not be affected. Still, the decision is likely to be used as fodder for claims by Trump and his Republican allies that the Justice Department has treated the Capitol riot defendants unfairly. It's unclear how the court's decision will affect the case against Trump, which includes charges other than obstruction. Special Counsel Jack Smith has said the charges faced by the former president would not be affected. Trump's case is on hold while the Supreme Court considers a separate case in which Trump is claiming immunity from prosecution. A decision is expected Monday. Under the ruling issued Friday, dozens of defendants could seek new sentences, ask to withdraw guilty pleas, or have charges dropped. Most defendants convicted of obstruction also were convicted of another felony, so their sentence may not be significantly impacted, if at all. The High Court returned the case of former Pennsylvania police officer Joseph Fisher to a lower court to determine if Fisher can be charged with obstruction. Fisher has been indicted for his role in disrupting Congress's certification of Democrat Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election victory over Trump. Fisher is among about 350 people who have been charged with obstruction. Some pleaded guilty to or were convicted of lesser charges. Republicans, who have cast the January 6th defendants as victims of political persecution, are certain to seize on the ruling to argue that the rioters have been prosecuted unfairly by the Justice Department. Trump has embraced January 6th defendants and floated pardons for the rioters if he wins in November. Trump posted on Truth Social shortly after the decision, calling the ruling a massive victory for J6 political prisoners. It's also likely to slow cases in a court clogged with January 6th defendants as judges are forced to grapple with how to apply the ruling. It's going to be a big mess, said Randall Eliason, a professor at George Washington University Law School and former federal prosecutor in Washington. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the court's opinion, joined by conservative justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Clarence Thomas, and by liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, a former federal public defender who also wrote a separate opinion. Bannon facing prison after court rejects request, by Sabrina Wilmer, Bloomberg News. Steve Bannon, a longtime advisor to President Donald Trump, lost his fight to stay out of prison while he challenges his conviction for contempt of Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday turned down Bannon's request to pause his four-month sentence, which is set to start Monday. Bannon sought to put off incarceration until his case could be considered by the country's highest court after he failed to persuade an appellate panel to overturn his conviction. The court rejected Bannon in a one-sentence order without any public dissent. 2 years ago, a jury found Bannon guilty of contempt for refusing to testify and hand over documents to the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. In his fight to get his conviction overturned, Bannon is challenging a long-standing court decision called Licavoli, which prevented him from using the advice of counsel defense to explain to jurors why he didn't respond to the congressional inquiry. Bannon is the latest in a line of Trump aides who have found themselves behind bars. Former White House advisor Peter Navarro is serving a four-month sentence in a Florida prison for similar charges. At least half a dozen other former Trump associates, including Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, and Alan Weisselberg, have served time. Shares of Trump media swing wildly day after presidential debate, by Michelle Chapman, The Associated Press. Trump media fell more than 10% Friday after the first U.S. presidential debate, demonstrating another of the wild swings that have made its stock one of the more volatile on Wall Street. Shares in the owner of social networking site Truth Social jumped 5% at the opening bell, then sank through much of the day. The shares still finished the week with a gain of more than 18%. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump clashed Thursday evening on topics including abortion, immigration, and the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Biden's performance was largely seen as uneven, particularly early on. He tried repeatedly to confront Trump, who countered Biden's criticism by leaning into falsehoods about the economy, illegal immigration, and his role in the January 6th insurrection. In political futures markets, where investors can put money on the political fates of candidates, Biden's odds of remaining the Democratic Party's nominee slid 29% after the debate. City analysts said Friday there may be increased interest in Trump media and technology based on headlines after the debate. Israel, Hamas at war. Survivors of massacre at music festival unite. By Melanie Lidman, The Associated Press. Tel Aviv, Israel. In the months since Hamas's surprise attack sent them scattering across fields or hiding in desert brush, thousands of survivors of a massacre at a trance festival in Israel have come together as a community to heal. They have found solace in massage therapy, ice baths, yoga, or surfing with the only people who could truly understand what they had been through. And they have built a robust support network for themselves as the Israel-Hamas war rages on and authorities struggle to provide services to devastated communities. For some, the way back has come through dancing again. On Thursday, thousands of people attended the Nova Healing Concert in Tel Aviv, the first Tribe of Nova mass gathering since the October 7th attack. We understood that people needed to be together, and we're a community that takes care of itself, said Omri Sasa, one of the founders of the Tribe of Nova, which organized the festival last October. I'm in trauma, and I wanted to be with people who also went through this. He was among about 3,000 people dancing through the night in a field just miles from Gaza when rockets lit up the sky at 6:29 a.m. Heavily armed Palestinian militants rampaged through the festival, killing at least 364 people and taking more than 40 hostage. Many of them are still held in Gaza. Hila Fakliro, a communication student who was tending bar at the festival, escaped by zigzagging through fields, hiding and running for more than 5 hours until she reached the safety of a village some 12 miles away. Six of her friends were killed and three were taken hostage. Someone asked me if I can dance again, and in the beginning I said no, she said. At a memorial in January for one of her friends, she tried to dance, had a panic attack, and then tried again. I was crying and dancing at the same time, she said. But after attending events organized by Nova survivors, she was once again able to find solace in the trance music she loves. At a recent event, she slid into an ice bath while others attended yoga and art classes in a cluster of tents. Omri Kohavi, 35, one of Nova's founding organizers, said they had felt abandoned by Israel's security forces, who took hours to respond to the October 7th attack. Now, director of community programming for the Nova Foundation, Kohavi said organizers realized within days that if we don't care for ourselves, no one else will. Survivors began to gather to deal with the trauma that they had experienced together. On the first day, 500 showed up. That number doubled the following day. After 3 months, they shifted to weekly community day events and encouraged survivors to return to their regular lives and jobs. At those events in Tel Aviv, survivors met with therapists, lawyers, or social workers, or just spent time with one another. The Nova Foundation connects survivors to opportunities for horse therapy, surfing, and massage. Some have completed training in peer therapy to help others, and the organization recently began providing support to the families of those killed. This month, Israel rescued 4 hostages who were snatched from the festival, which Sasa said was the biggest present anyone could imagine. The daytime rescue killed more than 270 Palestinians. The gathering Thursday was to raise money to support the volunteer network and to call for the release of the remaining hostages. To appeal to a broader audience, it featured electronic music and mainstream artists, as well as the Nova mainstay, trance. We need a lot of money, and the only way we know how to raise money is through events, Sasa said. Nova provided a separate area at the Nova Healing Concert for survivors and family members of victims and two hostages who were released during a ceasefire in November addressed the crowd. A chorus of mothers who lost their children performed. The war ignited by Hamas's attack is far from over. Some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, were killed in Israel on October 7th, and 250 were taken hostage. Israel's massive offensive in Gaza has killed more than 37,000 Palestinians, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants. Fears of another all-out war, this time with Hezbollah in Lebanon, have people on edge. Sivan Cohen, 30, said before the event Thursday that she would be dancing for two. Her partner of 6 years, Yanif Sarudi, 26, was killed while trying to drive a car filled with 9 festival goers to safety. Cohen was shot in the leg, and at first she wasn't sure if she would ever walk again, much less dance. My friends and I have grabbed this with both hands, and we come every week, Cohen said of Nova's community days. She said it's hard to explain to those who weren't there what it means to reunite with someone who was in that car or whose injuries she helped to treat. On Thursday, tens of thousands danced in the humid June heat, the beat pulsing as the sun set over the Nova stage. Quiet corners for reflection with mandalas and photos of the victims gave way to a massive party at the center stage. The only way to really commemorate these people is through living what they lived, which is dancing. That's what they came there to do, Ilal Porat said as he entered the festival. Uvalde, Texas. Indictment accuses former chief of delays, by Jim Vertuno, The Associated Press. Austin, Texas. The police chief for schools in Uvalde, Texas, failed to identify an active shooting, did not follow his training, and made critical decisions that slowed the law enforcement response to stop a gunman who was hunting victims and ultimately killed 21 people at Robb Elementary, according to an indictment unsealed Friday. Pete Arredondo was arrested and briefly booked into the Uvalde County Jail before being released Thursday night on 10 state jail felony counts of abandoning or endangering a child in the May 24, 2022 attack that killed 19 children and 2 teachers. Former school officer Adrian Gonzalez, one of the first officers to enter the building after the shooting began, was indicted on 29 similar charges that accuse him of abandoning his training and not confronting the shooter, even after hearing gunshots as he stood in a hallway. Gonzalez was booked into jail briefly Friday and released on bail. Arredondo, 52, and Gonzalez, 51, are the first officers to be charged for the police response to one of the worst school shootings in U.S. history. And the indictments from a Uvalde County grand jury follow 2 years of calls from some families for such action. Some victims' relatives said Friday that although they are happy Arredondo and Gonzalez were indicted, they want more officers to be charged. They decided to indict only two. That's hard for me to accept, said Jesse Rizzo, whose niece Jacqueline Cazares was among the students killed. In a statement, an attorney for Gonzalez called the charges against law enforcement unprecedented in the state of Texas. Mr. Gonzalez's position is he did not violate school district policy or state law, said Nico LaHood, the former district attorney for Bexar County, which includes San Antonio. The first U.S. law enforcement officer ever tried for allegedly failing to act during an on-campus shooting was a sheriff's deputy in Florida who didn't go into the classroom building and confront the perpetrator of the 2018 Parkland massacre. The deputy was acquitted of felony neglect last year. A lawsuit by the victims' families and survivors is pending. The indictment against Arredondo, who was the on-site commander at the Uvalde shooting, accused the chief of delaying the police response, despite hearing gunshots and being notified that wounded children were in the classrooms and that a teacher had been shot. Arredondo called for a SWAT team, ordered the initial responding officers to leave the building, and attempted to negotiate with the 18-year-old gunman, the indictment said. after being advised that a child or children were injured in a class at Robb Elementary School. Arradondo failed to identify the incident as an active shooter incident and failed to respond as trained to an active shooter incident and instead directed law enforcement officers to evacuate the wing before confronting the shooter, thereby delaying the response by law enforcement officers to an active shooter who was hunting and shooting a child or children, the indictment said. The actions and inactions by Arradondo and Gonzalez amounted to criminal negligence, the indictment said. More than 370 federal, state, and local officers converged on Robb Elementary, but they waited more than 70 minutes before confronting the shooter, even as the gunman could be heard firing an AR-15-style rifle. Terrified students inside the classroom called 911 as parents begged officers, some of whom could hear shots being fired while they stood in a hallway, to go in. A tactical team of officers eventually went into the classroom and killed the gunman. I want every single person who was in the hallway charged for failure to protect the most innocent, Velma Duran, whose sister Irma Garcia was one of the teachers killed, said Friday. My sister put her body in front of those children to protect them, something they could have done. They had the means and the tools to do it. It was unclear whether the grand jury considered indictments against any others. Arradondo is accused of failing to protect survivors of the attack, including Chloe Torres, who called 911 and begged for help, telling a dispatcher, "Please hurry. There's a lot of dead bodies. Some of my teachers are still alive, but they're shot." Gonzalez's indictment charges him with failing to protect children who were killed as well as survivors. Although the investigative report by Texas lawmakers identifies Gonzalez as one of the first officers to go in the building, it also identified two other officers who allegedly heard gunfire. It is unclear whether those officers were part of the grand jury's investigation. Transportation. Drivers fined $42 million in 8 months for express lane violations. By Bruce Finley, The Denver Post. Drivers on Colorado highways have been caught illegally crossing in or out of express lanes 361,451 times over the past 8 months, more than 1,400 violations per day. The Colorado Department of Transportation has issued $42 million in fines, state records show. The automated enforcement system that CDOT officials launched a year ago, a network of roadway surveillance sensors, cameras, and driver tracking technology, gradually is changing behavior, agency officials told the Denver Post. Express lane transgressions are decreasing, and 81% of violators do not incur a second violation, CDOT spokesman Tim Hoover said. But state data shows a problem. People driving way too fast in express lanes and in the other lanes, Hoover said. The complaint we hear is from people driving the speed limit or even slightly over who are being tailgated by speeders behind them, speeders who, before enforcement, were wantonly weaving in and out of the express lane to swerve around other cars, he said. Sometimes drivers also complain that cars in express lanes move slower than the speed limit, delaying express lane drivers who have paid for the access and expect to travel faster. The same speed limits apply in all lanes. The minimum speed limits also apply in express lanes. If you are driving behind someone going under the speed limit, your option is to just be patient and wait for the nearest exit from the express lane. You cannot weave over the double white lines to swerve around the slow-moving vehicle, Hoover said. A year ago, CDOT deployed the automated enforcement system to increase highway safety by deterring drivers from crossing over the double white lines that separate express lanes from other lanes. Drivers can enter or exit express lanes only at points designated with signs and dashed lines. State lawmakers in 2022 boosted CDOT's authority to crack down on transgressors. Colorado officials recorded 716 roadway deaths in 2023, down 6% compared with the record-setting 764 fatalities in 2022. Highway drivers caught crossing solid white lines face civil penalties, fines of $75, which double to $150 if not paid within 20 days. Although CDOT has levied $42 million in fines since October, the agency has collected only about $27 million of those fines. Fines collected from drivers are to be used as funding for highway safety projects. Douglas County High School. Affidavit: Teacher Assaulted Student in Classroom, by Katie Langford, The Denver Post. A longtime Douglas County High School teacher assaulted a student while they were alone in a classroom together, according to an arrest affidavit. Social studies teacher James Jim Christopher Tomer, 55, was arrested June 18th on suspicion of sexual assault on a child by someone in a position of trust. According to a sheriff's arrest affidavit, a student was talking to Tomer alone in a classroom on May 9th when Tomer tried to kiss him. The student's age and gender have been redacted from the report. The student told Tomer no, that Tomer was married and that this would ruin his life, and tried to move away. But Tomer followed them around the classroom and asked for just one kiss. Tomer put his hands inside the student's pants twice, and when the student put a hand on his chest to keep him away, Tomer said the student was driving him crazy, according to the affidavit. Tomer and the student later walked out of the school together and drove away separately. School surveillance video confirmed Tomer was alone in the classroom with the student for more than an hour, according to the affidavit. When interviewed by police, Tomer admitted to giving his phone number out to students and giving the student a ride in his car, but denied trying to kiss the student. He said he didn't think he did anything wrong, investigators wrote in the report. Tomer, a Centennial resident, began working at the Douglas County School District in 1999 and is on administrative leave pending investigation, according to district officials. Tomer was released on $20,000 bail and is set to appear in court July 18th, according to court records. Police shooting in Springs. Woman struck by suspect on video, by Lauren Pennington, The Denver Post. A man shot by Colorado Springs police officers while fleeing on foot this month struck a woman across the face with a gun in the city's downtown area before pointing it at another man, security footage released Thursday shows. At about 12:48 a.m. on June 9th, three officers with the police department's downtown response team were patrolling on foot along South Nevada Avenue when they heard a disturbance up the street, according to a video briefing released Thursday by the department. As one officer, identified as Benjamin Hengel, moved toward the disturbance, he saw a woman fall to the ground. He drew his stun gun, police department spokesperson Joe Frabiel said in the video. Another man chasing the suspect suddenly stopped and put his hands up, Frabiel said. When Hengel went to move around the man, Hengel saw the suspect pointing a gun in his direction and drew his department-issued handgun. Security footage from a nearby building before the shooting shows the suspect, 21-year-old Al Morion Germany, backing away from a woman while the two have what appears to be a verbal disagreement. In the video, Germany points what appears to be a gun at the woman before striking her across the face with it, knocking her to the ground. Germany turns to run and is quickly followed by three officers, including Hengel, security footage shows. Footage from Hengel's body camera shows officers yelling at Germany to drop the gun, following him down South Nevada Avenue and continuing the chase around the corner onto Pikes Peak Avenue when Germany ignored police commands to stop. Frabiel said Germany was running toward a parking lot the officers knew usually had a lot of foot traffic at that time of night. When Hengel turned the corner, he fired three shots at Germany, striking the man twice, body camera footage shows. The man continued to run after being shot and was taken into custody in the 100 block of East Pikes Peak Avenue. Officers provided medical aid until paramedics arrived, and Germany was taken to a hospital with injuries that are not life-threatening, according to Frabiel. Frabiel said a loaded 10mm Glock handgun was found near where Germany was shot, but did not confirm the gun belonged to Germany. The 21-year-old was arrested on suspicion of first-degree assault. The El Paso County Sheriff's Office and 4th Judicial District Attorney's Office are investigating the shooting and will determine if Hengel's use of force was justified. Western Slope. Blue Mesa Reservoir Bridge will open partially in time for holiday weekend, by Lauren Pennington, The Denver Post. The Blue Mesa Reservoir Bridge on US 50 is on track to open to limited traffic next week before the 4th of July holiday, sparing travelers potential hours and detours, according to the Colorado Department of Transportation. Repairs on the bridge started in May after state and federal transportation officials found a cracked steel girder during an April safety inspection and closed US 50 between Montrose and Gunnison. With the first phase of repairs complete, emergency vehicles and smaller passenger vehicles can start crossing over the US 50 bridge on Wednesday at 6:30 a.m., CDOT officials said in a news release. Gunnison County Road 26 will remain open and maintained as a detour for other vehicles, and Kepler Pass is now open as a seasonal route. We continue to work toward completing needed repairs ahead of winter, CDOT officials said in the release. Over the course of the holiday weekend, the bridge will be open for 12 hours a day, which we hope encourages tourism in this area, as these communities are still very much open for business. From Thursday through July 7th, one lane will be open and pilot cars will lead single-direction traffic across the bridge between 6:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m., the release stated. Starting on July 8th, the bridge will be open twice a day, and pilot cars will lead single-direction traffic across it from 6:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m., and again from 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m., officials said in the release. Construction crews will continue to work on repairs between the openings. Passenger vehicles, pickup trucks, vans, motorcycles, and emergency vehicles can all use the bridge after Wednesday, but RVs, campers, motorhomes, tractor trailers, buses, and trucks pulling trailers, including boats, campers, and side-by-sides, must continue to take the County Road 26 detour. CDOT officials expect the bridge to be fully reopened during the fall. Split Court backs camping bans, by Lindsay Whitehurst, The Associated Press. Washington. The Supreme Court cleared the way for cities to enforce bans on homeless people sleeping outside in public spaces on Friday, overturning a California appeals court ruling that found such laws amount to cruel and unusual punishment when shelter space is lacking. The case is the High Court's most significant on the issue in decades and comes as a rising number of people in the U.S. are without a permanent place to live. In a 6-3 decision along ideological lines, the High Court found that outdoor sleeping bans don't violate the Eighth Amendment. Western cities had argued that the ruling made it harder to manage outdoor encampments in public spaces, but homeless advocates said punishing people who need a place to sleep would criminalize homelessness. In California, which is home to one-third of the country's homeless population, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom said the decision gives state and local officials authority to clear unsafe encampments from the streets while acting with compassion. This decision removes the legal ambiguities that have tied the hands of local officials for years, he said. Justice Neil Gorsuch acknowledged those concerns in the opinion he wrote for the majority. Homelessness is complex. Its causes are many. So may be the public policy responses required to address it, he wrote. A handful of federal judges cannot begin to match the collective wisdom the American people possess in deciding how best to handle a pressing social question like homelessness. He suggested that people who have no choice but to sleep outdoors could raise that as a necessity defense if they are ticketed or otherwise punished for violating a camping ban. The ruling is likely to have limited impact in Denver and Aurora, which have active camping bans. But in Boulder, a lawsuit against the city's ban on camping in public spaces had been on hold while the Supreme Court case played out. Friday's ruling is likely to aid Boulder's defense of its ordinance. Denver's camping ban, passed by the City Council in 2012, has come under legal challenge multiple times, at one point being ruled unconstitutional by a Denver County judge in 2019. That decision was reversed, and the city later entered into a settlement with homeless advocates in which officials agreed to give 7 days' notice before clearing out most encampments. Most recently, an initiative launched by Mayor Mike Johnston often has paired the clearing of large camps with temporary housing for their inhabitants in hotels or micro-communities. Homeless advocates, on the other hand, have said that allowing cities to punish people who have no other place to sleep ultimately would make the crisis worse. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday Denver Post, read by Doug Crane.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.